Welcome back to the Holistic Nutritionist Podcast. My name is Natalie Douglas, and I am bringing you a really special and I think important conversation. In this episode, I interviewed Dr. Tracy Chandler, and we're talking all things checking your boobs. And it is a topic that is extraordinarily close to my heart. And for those of you who know our beautiful Kate Callahan, who went through her own breast cancer journey earlier this year and unfortunately is no longer earthside with us, Tracy was part of her treatment team, a really close friend and support to her during that time, and someone who I think has such a beautiful approach to holistic medicine and integrative medicine. And I really couldn't think of a better person to invite on the show and to have this discussion with you all. So before we dive into the episode, I wanted to give you a bit of a background on Tracy. So she was born in Canada and grew up and trained in England. She's married to her soulmate Grant, and they have seven children. Tracy completed a biochemistry degree and her primary medical training in England, and this gave her a more in-depth knowledge of the human body than most doctors are required to know. She then worked as a GP before doing further postgraduate training in sports and integrative medicine and nutrition. Her decision to specialize in integrative medicine partly evolved through her increasing awareness of the impact of nutrition and environment on her own personal and her patients' health and well-being. Whilst working and raising her family, she became unwell and experienced the frustrations of conventional medicine not being able to provide a solution for her healing. It was then she discovered the power of integrative or functional medicine. This combines the best of conventional and complementary medicine and biochemistry to treat the root cause of poor health. With her own health experience and being a recovering perfectionist, Tracy takes your health very personally. So I really hope you enjoy today's chat and learn a whole bunch of really empowering information. And please, if you have found this episode to be, or if you do find this episode to be useful, then share with your friends, your fam, whoever, because I think this is a conversation that we all need to be part of. Enjoy. Tracy, welcome to the Holistic Nutritionist Podcast. It's so good to have you with us, and, you know, a long time coming. Kate and I were talking about having you on the podcast probably for about a year before I actually reached out to you, so better late than never, and I'm sure she's tuning in with us as well.
I reckon. Hi, Nat. Lovely to see you.
So the first thing I wanted to start off the discussion with is just wondering if there's anything that's exciting you or inspiring you or interesting you at the moment in the world of holistic or integrative medicine.
Oh my goodness, how long have you got? No, I'm kidding.
You're limited to one.
Probably mitochondria. They sound really boring and probably not a lot of people know what they are, but we used to think they were just like the furnaces in our cells making energy, which is really important. But now we know they're kind of like a backup to the immune system. So they help the immune system out. And if they feel threat from any stressor, which could be chemical stressors, heavy metals, food intolerance, the classical emotional psychological stressors, even physical stress like too much exercise or infections, then they'll instead of making energy, they'll help the immune system out. And that's why we've got this massive epidemic of things like chronic fatigue, or even just the norm, I won't call it normal fatigue, but this epidemic of fatigue that we're seeing more and more in general practice. Like when I first started practicing 20 years ago, I might see one fatigue patient a week. Now I'm seeing, I'm in integrative medicine, so every patient's fatigued, but certainly I know when I do the odd GP locum, probably at least 80% of patients are fatigued. So it's definitely an epidemic, and it's because the mitochondria are so busy doing this other job of helping the immune system out, they're not doing their primary job of making energy.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I don't think it sounds boring at all. I'm like, mitochondria, my like little ears lit up. And I think it is. I love that you bring that as well around fatigue, because I see a lot of chronic fatigue patients as well. And something that really bothers me is that it is often given out, at least in my experience, as like, oh, you have chronic fatigue, like full stop. Whereas I'm sure you're similar in the way of wondering, well, why are you chronically fatigued? Not just here's the label, here's the box that you're in, now just deal with it. But, you know, talking about things like mitochondria, looking at, well, what could possibly be creating this situation? Because it feels really unfair to me to say to someone, well, you have chronic fatigue syndrome, full stop, and that's it.
Yeah, and that's so common. I saw an 11-year-old boy who was diagnosed with chronic fatigue. Wow. And he was basically told just to go and lie in bed until he got better. Mm-hmm. After 3 months, he was getting quite depressed, understandably, because he was a previously sporty kid. His parents were getting more and more anxious. It took some really simple measures to bring him right, and he didn't have to lie around for months doing that. We just brought in some integrative medicine techniques, and he was back snowboarding competitively within a few months, which is so exciting. So that's one of the things that's exciting about mitochondria is, you know, we've got so many tools, you and I, where we can really target those mitochondria and not have patients be told, oh, you're fatigued, just go and lie down and rest, or you've got fatigue, you're probably depressed, here's an antidepressant, which is what a lot of patients are told as well, or it's all in your head, you know, you're just imagining it, which is another thing I've heard patients be told.
Yeah, I get that all of the time, particularly with, you know, I see a lot of Hashimoto's and thyroid patients, and they're often just told, well, you're just depressed, and here's just take this and it'll be better. And I think it's really disempowering, because it's almost like this disconnect and distrust of their body, that their body is like not doing the right thing by them, when really our body is always doing the best it can to try and help us survive. And often we just need to figure out, well, what is it that it's missing from like that resource pool that it needs in order to thrive?
Yeah, and that's the great thing about the tools that we have, is a really digging deep to find out what is annoying those mitochondria. You know, that I love that analogy of any symptom as being like the warning light on your car dashboard. And the conventional approach, which I did for 20 years, so I know it really well, is to take that bulb out by giving people a tablet or a cream. Whereas, you know, what you and I do is we get under the bonnet to find out why that light came on. And that's, and we look at the whole engine at the same time, not just the bit that the light came on for.
Yeah, 100%. And it's definitely more challenging in some ways, but it's definitely gets better results. And I find it exciting. I kind of like, it's like playing a game of Cluedo. It's like, where does the problem lie? It is rewarding to find it.
Oh, absolutely. I did biochemistry before medicine. I'm so totally a biochemistry geek. And my dad was a detective, so I think that's where I love delving deep into people's problems.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. I love it. So good. And, you know, it can take, I think, like longer sometimes, but not if that makes sense. Like, I think it's an investment of resources in lots of different ways, but it is the kind of stuff, the kind of work that pays off over the long term. And I'm such a fan of looking at everything as a whole. And I don't know about you, but the more I learn about, you know, psychosomatic kind of healing and therapy, and we have a really beautiful mutual friend Jin who's been on the podcast. And I love the kind of stuff she does around emotions and their impact on our physical manifestations of what's happening. And it's, gosh, like, it's just so fascinating.
Oh, it is. And, you know, the quantum physics has really proven that how our thoughts affect our health. So I'm a big believer in the quantum healing and using the power of our thoughts to change the energy of our cells. And changing the energy of our cells definitely helps improve the biochemistry. I mean, there's certainly a place in nutrition and supplements, but that mind-body healing is incredibly powerful and is certainly one of the tools that I use when I see patients. And yeah. Sounds like you do too.
Yeah. Oh, we could nerd out on this forever. I feel a calling to actually get to the topic that I asked you to come on about. So true. I want to shift gears a little bit and start to talk about, you know, breast health, breast screening, because it is a topic that is close to both of our hearts, having had Kate go through the journey that she's gone through. And I know that this is a topic that she would be wanting to continue to talk about and raise awareness around. And I guess where I wanted to start the conversation is just around like getting checked for breast lumps and how do we do that and where do we start?
Yeah, good question. Well, getting to know a breast is really important. And so I recommend that women start really quite early, you know, in their 20s when their breasts are fully developed. And the key thing is when you do breast self-examination that you do it at the same time in your cycle each month, because they do change with the cycle. So, I mean, women know that they tend to get a little bit more engorged, a little bit more painful towards the period. And so there's some good evidence of how they change. So doing it at the same time each month is really key. And using the flat of your fingers, because if you dig in with the tips of your fingers, the breasts are inherently quite lumpy. So you're probably going to find lumps if you dig in with the tips of your fingers. Whereas if you use the flat of the fingers, then you find what is known as a more discreet or a true lump, because the breasts can get quite thickened with the ducts. And also where you examine as well is really important. So a lot of women think they just examine where you can see the breast, but you want to think of the breast as being like a teardrop shaped, with the point of the tear being right up at the armpit. So as well as examining that whole area, including behind the nipple, examining the armpits. And the best way to do that is to lift your arm up, dig your fingers right into the top of the armpit, starting on the chest side, and then bring your arm down, which helps to loosen the skin over the armpit. So you can really dig in there and have a good old feel around on the chest side and then on the arm side as well, and obviously both sides. It's quite hard to tickle yourself, so don't worry about digging in really deep. And also lying down, take your time, because massage, even self-massage, which is what breast examination is really good for our parasympathetic nervous system, which is our rest and repair nervous system. So anytime, you know, drying yourself with a towel or putting your cream on is a good opportunity, and breast exam is a good opportunity for activating our rest and repair nervous system. If you have large breasts, sort of about a D or above, then use your non-examining hand to stabilize your breast so it doesn't flop around, and then pressing around. And get your partners involved as well. You know, get them to, I'm sure they won't mind too much having to examine your breast.
You don't have to pull through any strings to get that one happening.
I reckon. So yeah, getting them to, you know, get to know your breasts as well, because then I've heard so many times actually a woman will come in and say, oh, my partner said he can feel a lump. So, you know, definitely get them involved. So that's what I would start with in terms of yourself, and then of course ideally having an annual breast exam by the same doctor, ideally, and ideally they would be a breast specialist, meaning a breast surgeon. GPs know how to examine breasts, definitely, but they won't be examining as many breasts as a breast surgeon. So if you can, have an annual check by a breast surgeon. And then if you're in the right age group, which is different in the different countries, then you can have mammography, ultrasound investigations, and thermography as well. I recommend annual thermography starting really young, at about the age of 20, because then you get a baseline when you're likely very healthy. And with thermography, the best way to use it is to track it over time and looking for changes.
Sorry to interrupt. What is thermography like? Is it like what is it showing?
Yeah, so it's looking at the health of the breast. It's looking at the thermal signature, if you like, the heat signature of the breast, to determine if there's any sort of hot spots. Hot spots would indicate that there's a likely condition. It doesn't mean cancer. So it's not a cancer diagnosis test. It's more of a breast health test and tracking that over time and adding it into mammography, self-examination, breast surgeon examination. The more things you can do, the more accurate the diagnosis tends to become. And the sooner you tend to pick things up as well.
And you know how you've said at the beginning there, when we're doing breast checks, to do it at the same time of the month, would that be the same when you're doing any of these other examinations in terms of doing it at the same time of the month, whether it's different scans or having a breast check done by someone else?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you want to have it at the same time. That's for premenopausal women. Postmenopausal women, it doesn't matter. But for premenopausal, yeah, the same time each cycle is always the best.
And is there like any particular time of the cycle that you'd recommend, or is it more just about, you know, comparing apples with apples, so just doing it at the same time?
Yeah, more comparing apples with apples, but towards the end of the cycle, just before the period, the breasts tend to become a bit engorged, a bit painful. So things like mammography, which is where the breasts are flattened in between the mammography plates, can be a little bit more painful at that time of the cycle. Mm. So sort of just after the period seems to be the best time.
Yeah. Nice. And then what about, so we've talked about different times like in a cycle where breast tissue can change. Is there any other like situations where your breast tissue would be, you know, quite different that people should be aware of?
Yeah, definitely. So if the cycles aren't regular and this nice length and there's no spotting in between, then that would indicate that there's a little bit of hormone imbalance. I mean, certainly there are a lot more what we call exogenous estrogen sources around these days, from, you know, pesticides, and even the creams and things that we put on our face can affect hormones. The food that we eat, a lot of meat and dairy is full of hormones, especially if it's non-organic. And that can affect our hormone imbalance. But a way of telling, I mean, it's not foolproof, but a way of telling whether or not there's any hormone symptoms which can then affect the breasts and therefore the imaging of the breasts is whether or not you've got nice regular cycles, not nice regular periods. So, but if you do have any other symptoms such as, you know, mastitis or any other type of infection of the breast, any rashes, then, or any obvious things like lumps, and that you'd be wanting to have more diagnostic imaging as opposed to screening imaging, which is done quite differently.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of like women, if they're going through pregnancy or breastfeeding, should they still be doing regular checks in that context? Because obviously breast tissue, I mean, I know for Kate, like she was breastfeeding and you know, she was like, well, I'm breastfeeding, like my boobs are a little bit lumpy at this point in time, or like there's different kind of situations that might pop up, and I can imagine that it would be very easy to normalize changes in breast tissue where, you know, maybe some of the time that's absolutely fine and then some of the time it's not. So if someone is pregnant or breastfeeding, is there any recommendations around how they should manage self-checks or screening?
Yeah, I mean, again, because we tend to be, thankfully, pregnant for quite a long time in some ways, that, you know, we can, I mean, the breasts do change over the course of the pregnancy, but you can, again, you know, do a baseline when you're first pregnant and just keep checking it over monthly over the cycle, bearing in mind, yes, they are more lumpy during the pregnancy and during breastfeeding. But it's all about getting to know your breasts and doing those regular checks. And then if you do notice any symptoms, and that's not just breast lumps, it can be a change in the appearance. And so when you do that breast exam, the other thing I forgot to mention is putting your arms up above your head and looking in the mirror. And then arms down by your side, again, looking in the mirror. So you're looking also not just for lumps, but for dimpling, any change in the appearance, any change in the size, any rashes. So, you know, that's why it's really good to get to know our breasts. But, yeah, certainly in breastfeeding and pregnancy, you wouldn't be doing mammography, but you can do ultrasound. So if you do have any symptoms, a really key thing is to get checked, ideally by a breast surgeon, but if not, your GP, and then they can decide whether or not that needs to have further investigation.
Yeah. Okay. That's really good to know, because I think it can be really confusing when it comes to, you know, screening and how to do it and when to do it and why to do it. And I think even for myself, to be completely transparent with you, until everything happened with Kate, I hadn't really ever even considered checking my breasts. It felt like this really impossible thing, because I'm really healthy, I look after myself, I don't have any history. And then when Kate went through what she went through, I thought, oh shit, like I can't just assume that, and it's not about fear, but I can't just assume that because I look after myself really well, that there's just absolutely no chance. And in fact, making sure that I'm empowering myself by being really familiar with my breasts, as you've said there.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the mammography screening covers 45 to 69-year-olds in New Zealand. There are certain regional differences as well. Like in South Canterbury, where I live, there's extra funding for women 70 to 74. But there are also there's also at-risk screening. And so, you know, if a woman has any doubts about whether or not she's at risk, it's worth just checking with their GP, because we can also do more often screening or younger screening for someone who's had a previous breast cancer, or they're within 5 years of the age the mother or sister was diagnosed with premenopausal breast cancer, or aged more than 40 with breast histology, meaning they've had a sample of a breast taken and demonstrating an at-risk lesion, a mother or sister with premenopausal breast cancer or postmenopausal bilateral breast cancer, meaning both breasts, or if they're high risk as assessed by a specialist radiologist. Although the screening is for 45 to 69-year-olds, there does seem to be increasing prevalence in younger women, and that's why I recommend starting thermography at 20 and getting to know your breasts really, really well. If you're at all concerned, get checked and keep getting checked. And that's interesting. There's been a new category of women that are now being looked at a little bit more in terms of recommendations to GP of who should be referred, is women who have repeated consultations about the same problem, meaning the same lump, for example. So they're not just being just because they're coming in all the time, you know, that doesn't mean they're going to be ignored. They'll definitely be looked at a little bit more often, which is really reassuring and something new that seems to be happening.
So good. And I guess it is really about being proactive and empowered, instead of like me making assumptions that it's all fine, or being really fear-based behind it. I think, you know, like before you mentioned that there's kind of screening tools versus diagnostic tools. So what fits into each of those boxes? So screening being like breast checks, what else fits into that box versus going down that more diagnostic path?
Screening, so that would also be things like mammograms, thermograms, ultrasounds as well, but they tend to reserve ultrasounds for the diagnostic. I mean, there's certainly a lot of regional and country differences, but certainly in New Zealand, screening would be mammography and getting checked by a breast surgeon or by your GP.
Yeah. And are there any, I don't know how much you're able to say about different types of screening, but when it comes to things like mammograms and x-rays, are there any risks associated with going down that path of having being exposed to mammograms or x-rays? And is it a matter of just pros and cons, or what does the research, or what do you know about that so far?
Yeah, it's interesting with the radiation. It's one of the least concerning side effects. Certainly, the original studies on mammography do show that the benefits outweigh the radiation risk. However, they shouldn't be ignored. And it's important that women know that there can be, what it seems to be in the studies, about one cancer caused by screening radiation for every 2,000 cancers identified. So it's not negligible. It definitely is a radiation risk. But the biggest, if you like, side effects, probably not the right, biggest risk is overdiagnosis. So it's quite interesting if you look at the stats for this. So overdiagnosis, if you assume that screening reduces breast cancer mortality by 15% and that overdiagnosis and overtreatment is at 30%, what that means is that for every 2,000 women invited for screening throughout 10 years, one will avoid dying of breast cancer, and 10 healthy women who have not have been diagnosed if there had been no screening would be treated unnecessarily. Further, more than 200 women will experience important psychological distress, including anxiety, uncertainty for years because of false positive findings. So it's real, and that was from the Cochrane database, which is a very well-respected database. And as they said at the end of that study, it's really important that women are fully informed before they decide whether or not to attend screening. France and Switzerland actually have recommended against continuing screening is currently offered, and they're looking at, that was in 2017, and they're looking at what is a better option. So they're doing a big review. The other thing is to think about that there are other countries that have recommended carrying on the screening. But it may be that, you know, where there's a difference with some countries recommending screening and some countries not, is that some of the panels that reviewed these studies may be compromised by conflicts of interest of the members. Mm-hmm. So it is really controversial in a nutshell, and it's really hard for, you know, the general public to work out what is the best. I think from what I can surmise from all the studies, it seems to be that doing a combination of things is the best. So doing the breast self-examination, getting checked by ideally a breast examination expert, like a breast surgeon, mammography, if you're in the right age group, plus thermography as well, which the advantage of thermography is it can be done, you know, earlier from the age of 20. It's pain-free, it's non-contact, and there's no radiation risk.
And for someone, and you might only know this answer in the context of New Zealand, but if someone wants to get thermography done, like what route do they go down? Is it they go to the GP, their GP can refer them, or is it going through like a breast cancer clinic or a breast screening clinic? How do they actually go about accessing that?
Yeah, so there's a clinic in New Zealand called clinicalthermography.co.nz, and they do screening all over New Zealand. So you can just make an appointment yourself. You don't need to be referred.
Oh, that's handy. I wonder if there's something like that in Australia. I'll have to look into it and get back to everyone. That's interesting. And that's actually very fascinating. I never knew about that overdiagnosis type thing, and that's the question I was going to ask, which you've answered, is how do we protect against that? And I guess it is, as you're saying, by trying to track several markers instead of relying on one thing. But that's heartbreaking to hear that there's that degree of overdiagnosis, because I can imagine that the treatment is not without its own side effects in lots of different ways. But I just, like, what are the alternatives that they're exploring in these other countries? Do you know, or is it still very much a state of exploration?
Yeah, I don't know. It's quite recent, that study, relatively. But the other thing that's quite interesting, they're looking at another study, which is a meta-analysis, so pretty high-powered study that they used UK population data. And for 1,000 women invited to twice yearly or every 2 year mammography screening for 20 years, so they looked at 20 years from the age of 50, 2 to 3 women are prevented from dying of breast cancer. Just not very many. It's quite a small number.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. That's blown my mind. I'm going to have to go back and read some of that research as well, because I think, and I can imagine that if if it's, you know, I'm very interested in health, and I know that, you know, many of my friends are as well. And I know that we've had conversations of that are similar in terms of really not understanding all of this to the degree at which we probably should. And I can only imagine that people who, the general public, who maybe aren't that interested in health or don't have any significant motivation to be broadly exploring all of this stuff, that it's just not getting out there as much. Like, I mean, how many people maybe besides you and I are reading PubMed stuff in our spare time?
There's not many biochemistry and health geeks out there, is there? But yeah, it's quite interesting. There was a study that showed that over 50% of all women asked thought mammography reduced the risk of dying from breast cancer by at least 50%.
Wow.
When it's actually, if you look at the risk of dying from breast cancer with mammography, it's about 15 per thousand women. Mm. And without mammography, it's 17 to 18 per thousand women. So there's only 2 or 3 women per thousand women that are positively affected by having mammography. It's not, it's certainly, you know, it's one of the tools, but I don't think it should be relied on solely. That's where these other methodologies such as thermography, breast self-exam and breast surgeon exam as well is best.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think that it's really about trying to spread that message more. And I do think, at least it's my perception, that we are starting to have more open, honest conversations about women's health and empowering them in that way. And I also think that this conversation, particularly around breast health and breast checks, needs more attention. I think there's a lot, in my opinion, going on around talking about female hormones and contraception and the different pros and cons around, you know, those different areas of, you know, hormonal birth control, etc. And I do think women are becoming more empowered and educated and understanding their cycles better, but I feel that there's still not a lot of understanding around, yeah, breast checks, breast health, which, you know, hopefully we're starting to shift that even in this one conversation. And I think just starting to encourage people to get to know their bodies and their breasts is, you know, so, so good, because I think we are often outsourcing our own health to other people in a way that is disempowering, whereas I think there needs to be more trust built in our ability to know our own body and trust our gut when we do feel like something is off, and, you know, bringing in other people to help unpack that. But I just think, yeah, it's about empowerment and trusting that you know your body best.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when I see patients, I see myself as being their guide, someone to give them, you know, information about the various tools that can help them. But at the end of the day, they, as you say, they know their bodies better than anyone. And I think that whole empowering patients is what you and I are really keen to do. And then when they have symptoms, that they don't ignore them. And when you get to know your body better and you listen to it better and trust it, then you definitely, you know, can be quite pushy with getting symptoms dealt with and not ignored.
Yes, absolutely. It's so true. And like when it comes to, we've touched on so much to do with, you know, breast screening and breast health, and you've definitely busted a few myths that I wasn't even aware of. So thank you. Is there any other, you know, questions or that frequently come to you that you're finding yourself having to explain multiple times to people, or other kind of myths in relation to breast cancer or breast cancer risk that you would like to share with us?
Yeah, absolutely. The big one is that people assume that because they've got a family history of breast cancer, or even if they've got the gene mutation that causes breast cancer, that means they all get breast cancer. That is so not true. I call it the GABHAG hypothesis. It's one I made up. I might make a hashtag, actually.
Yes, which is, I suggest this.
which basically stands for go away bad and hello awesome genes. So meaning GABHAG, we can GABHAG our genes, we can turn off those pesky bad genes, and we can turn on our good genes using all the techniques and tools that you and I teach our patients. So it's not a death sentence. And actually, when I do all my public talks, that is the main thing that people say to me, is that, oh my goodness, you gave me hope. I assumed that because my mum had breast cancer that I was going to get breast cancer. That's so not true. It's only about 5%, maybe 7% of diseases are caused by true gene inheritance. The rest are all nutrition, lifestyle, environmental. I mean, you'll know there's this study, New Science of Epigenetics, which is basically how we can turn our good and bad genes off using the power of the environment, nutrition and environment. So that's one of the biggest myths. The other one would be that we only have to worry about breast lumps. Now, definitely you want to think about those other breast symptoms I talked about, which is armpit lumps, ulcerations, skin dimpling, any change in the appearance of the breasts, eczema as well, or nipple retraction, which is new. I mean, certainly a lot of women do have inners, which are the, or innies, which are the nipples that go in, but if it's new, then definitely get it checked out. And nipple discharge as well. You know, get all nipple discharge checked out. Unless it's obviously breast milk when you're breastfeeding. And then finding a lump means you have cancer. That's another myth. It just because there's a lump there does not mean you have cancer. So don't freak out. Just get it checked. It could, it's most likely to be something completely benign. And then probably the next one is a little bit I don't know what's the right word for it, but just because you've seen a GP who said they'll do a referral, or if they've done a referral, that you will get an investigation done, because, you know, as much as most docs are type A perfectionists, they are all overloaded humans and mistakes happen. And I've heard of referrals getting lost in the system. So, you know, the key thing there is if you don't have an appointment in 2 weeks for investigation, when you've presented with a breast symptom, chase it up. Don't just leave it. Don't just assume it's happening and there's just a big waiting list. You know, be that annoying person, the squeaky wheel gets oiled. Be the squeaky wheel. Be quite annoying. So those would be probably the main myths. And also men, you know, men assume they don't get breast cancer and they can. So just making sure the men do regular self-checks as well.
Yeah, that's true. I like that one. That's a good share. And I think, you know, to ask another question, and you might or might not have an answer to this one, but with that, you know, breast cancer genes, like investigations, do you think that it is something that people should investigate to know whether they have that predisposition, or do you think that knowing does more harm than good because people are making such like radical assumptions around it?
Yeah, it's such a hard one. I'm really in two minds about it. And I can tell you what I would do if it were me after I've said this bit, but I think women knowing can be empowering. If you've got the right person and they find out they do have the gene, it can be really motivating for them to change their whole nutrition and lifestyle program. So that's a reason I would be for it. But then you can get other people, and it really depends on the patient. I think you and I can kind of judge who would be the right person to have the test and not. But some people, if they have the test, they can really freak out, and it might make them drink more alcohol, which is one of the worst things you can do for the breast. So it's such a hard one. I mean, me personally, I wouldn't have the test because I think I'd be one of those ones that would get a little bit anxious about it. But then I think it is appropriate for other people. You know, I'm already doing a lot of really good things, so I don't feel I need it for the motivation, but certainly there are other patients who it would be really helpful for. And I think as long as patients are having a really good informed discussion, so they can make informed consent with a really good practitioner, ideally, you know, an integrated medicine practitioner like yourself, myself, then I think, and then they decide to go ahead with it, that would be fine. So as long as you're informing them and they're making informed consent, I think it's fine.
Yeah. And I think that that's like, I wholeheartedly agree with everything you've said there. I can totally resonate with personally and professionally, you know, thinking of, yes, the type of people where it would be something that is empowering versus something that is anxiety provoking. And it's interesting because when I think of the patients where I'm like, well, it would definitely cause a lot more anxiety than it would empowerment, they're often already the patient that is doing all of the right things anyway. So I think, like, would it change anything, like, except to make them anxious? I guess that's the kind of filter I put it through. And I actually think, to a degree, I have this, you know, love-hate relationships with genetic testing in general, like nutrigenomics, you know, checking, you know, we have these tools available to us now where we can do all of these different gene testings when it comes to nutrients and how we metabolize different things and all that kind of stuff. And sometimes I love it and I think it's great information. It's really exciting and it's really interesting. And then there's this other part of me that sometimes I'm like, well, you know, if it's not going to change the recommendation of what I would do, then do I use it? Because it tends to pigeonhole some people or create this fear that otherwise wouldn't be there. I don't know if you have that relationship with nutrigenomics or anything like that. It's, for me, it's, I'm like, oh, I love it, I hate it, I love it, I hate it.
Oh God, we're like twins. I'm exactly the same. Sometimes I think, oh, I should do a lot of testing, and I'm like, no, it's just going to make people quite anxious. And as you say, often the patients we're seeing are really doing a lot of the techniques they should be doing anyway, and it just adds not only the expense of the test but an added layer of anxiety. I mean, I think there are some things that are worth doing sooner, like, you know, starting breast self-examinations at 20, starting thermography at 20, because in some ways the earlier you start things like that, the more it normalizes it.
Yeah.
Kind of like a woman having cervical smear, it becomes more of a kind of a normal, what do you call them, warrant of fitnesses in Australia? We call them MOTs in England, where you get your, to take your car for an annual checkup. Is it called a warrant of fitness?
Gosh, you're asking the wrong person. that one's outsourced to the husband.
Fair enough. So yeah, the warrant, it's kind of like an annual, you know, warrant of fitness on your car. Some of these things I think can be helpful and in some ways down-regulate anxiety, because they just become, oh yeah, I'm just going for my breast self-exam, or I'm just going for my breast thermography. But yeah, genetic testing I think is a whole another level of stress. I think where they come in handy is if I have a patient who we've done absolutely everything, you know, all the tools that you and I use with patients, and they're on all the supplements and they're not getting anywhere, that can be helpful to explain, for example, why their vitamin D levels aren't going up, because they've got, you know, vitamin D receptor issues.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's so true. And I the filter I always put things through now, which has mostly served me well, is will this test change how I treat this person? And that often helps, because in some situations, like particularly with gut stuff, I find is really helpful. And often the answer is, well, what comes up here will probably change what I'm recommending, versus, you know, perhaps doing some, you know, not needed yet nutrigenomic testing, or, you know, it might be sometimes with cortisol testing, if I can see that there are, you know, lots of things that we need to do foundationally anyway before going down the path of doing, you know, in-depth cortisol testing, I will implement the basics first. And then if we're still seeing a problem, then look at, okay, so where do we need to get a little bit more savvy?
Yeah, exactly. I do actually, the other tests I do quite a lot, which is relevant to breast cancer, is the Dutch urine hormone testing, because I love the fact that it can tell me not only where the hormones are going. So that's the advantage of it over the standard blood test, which just tells you about the hormones, so estrogen, progesterone, testosterone. The Dutch test tells us what happens to your estrogen, you know, what metabolic pathways does it go down? How is it being cleared by the body? And as you know, one of those pathways puts it more puts us more at risk of cancer, and the other pathway can lower your risk of cancer, and we can switch those pathways if we know about it. And it also tells us about how damaged your DNA is, which can be a bit frightening. But the good thing about that test compared to the genetic testing, I feel, is that we can do something about the, you know, the damage to the DNA using all the techniques we teach patients. So I think those sort of tests, and as you say, the bowel testing is really helpful. So I do quite a lot of that testing.
Yeah, I love that test as well. It is very interesting. And I completely agree with you. And I think in the hands of the right practitioner, explaining it in an empowering way and making sure that who you're talking to understands and doesn't just hear, you know, your estrogen is going down the breast cancer pathway, but at the moment, like, this is where it's being channeled, but here's what we can do about it, and that it is something that can be changed, I think is really empowering. And I know that is having that Dutch test or Eve test done in New Zealand was the one that Kate actually did, and that prompted her to, you know, do more investigations in terms of what was happening for her. And I think actually I've seen several of Kate's previous clients who have since had an Eve test done themselves and then come to me with looking at those investigations and trying to understand it. And I've done the Dutch test on many of my patients as well. And I do think it's something where if you can afford to invest in the test, which it is an investment, it gives great information. And I personally try and do one once a year just to see what's going on with my own hormones and recognize that, yes, it is a snapshot in time, but that whatever you find there can be influenced by what you're putting in your body, your thoughts, you know, your exercise, your environment, and that it is, if you choose it to see it in an empowering way, then that's exactly what it can be.
That's right. And it can be very motivating for patients to, you know, think, oh, but, you know, I've had patients say, I really wanted to hang on to my coffee, or I really wanted to hang on to my red wine. And they see the test results, and then it prompts them to get off the caffeine and alcohol, which are, you know, especially the alcohol is really good for breast health and when you get off it. But it's interesting, the cost, you know, we talked about the investment. And I don't know what it's like in Aussie, but in New Zealand, you pay about $30 to $50 for, say, a vitamin D or a zinc test, which is one. One marker, but the Dutch test, you're paying about $1.50, $2 per marker. So although you happen to have a lot of markers in one go, I think the cost per marker is really good value.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think it's really I always find it confronting sometimes to have conversations with people generally around investment of different tests, because I think that in some ways it's really about being self-responsible and recognizing that you have a choice of where you invest your money. And a lot of people will, you know, spend $350, $400 on something that might be like a weekend away, which is lovely, and you should absolutely do that because that's important too, but and kind of not blink an eye, but then to spend that amount of money on a test for your health feels really, oh my gosh, like I can't do that. Whereas I think it is a gift to yourself, and it is something that is empowering you to make amazing decisions, and that I don't think that it should be seen as a luxury. I think it's more of a gift and an investment, and I think it can save a lot of money down the track, because so often when you're just stabbing in the dark, it takes longer to get to where you need to get to versus having specific tests in front of you and matching that up with symptoms and being able to lay out a much clearer path.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I tell people, just, is there something like, for example, I've got people have two or three cafe coffees. They will just maybe have two instead of three, or one instead of two, and put about $4 or $5 now, and put that money in a tin, and then you've got your money for your test in probably about 3 months' time. So, you know, just little things like that, because the tests are just so valuable and can be really quite life changing, I've found, for people.
Yes, I love nerding out on a good test. It's fun. We should be best friends, really. That's what I've come to the conclusion of in this talk.
I know. I have to move to New Zealand.
Oh, I'm working on it. So I also really want to bring people's attention to some of the exciting things that you have coming up, because I know that you've been working very hard behind the scenes at making functional medicine and integrative medicine more accessible. So do you want to tell us a little bit about what you've been working on and what is coming?
Oh, this is a wee sideline project for me, my spare time.
Yes, your spare time.
I don't actually know what spare time is, but anyway, is to bring, as you say, to bring integrative medicine to the masses, because it's not, your and my services aren't funded by the government, and yet the tools that we teach people and how we help people is just mind-blowing. You and I have both got incredible testimonials to that effect. I also want to get integrative medicine out to my colleagues. So I'm speaking at the New Zealand GP College conference next year, which is just mind-blowing that they've invited us to do an integrative medicine workshop for a whole day. It's very exciting news. So it's becoming more mainstream, which is great. Which will help it become more available to, everyone on the planet, which is my goal. Mm-hmm. And so along to that effect, I've created this course, which is looking like it will be a 10-week course, which is fully automated. So that brings the costs right down for people to be able to learn all the integrative medicine tools that can help them reach full health for as long as possible. Because that's actually, but that is a myth. People think that it's normal to have symptoms and they should just put up with symptoms because they're getting older. But that's so not true. And I really believe that everyone should realize, and that's what I'm hoping my course will do, is to teach them that no symptom is normal and they should have everything looked at. So I'm hoping to have that course launched by the end of January. So please follow me on social media where I'll be releasing the news about that.
I'll definitely make sure I tag you in the post and pop everything in the show notes, because that's really exciting. So, so good.
Thanks, Nat.
No problem. And if people do want to connect with you at the moment or work with you, what other avenues do you have available? So you've got that course coming. Are you still open? Are your books still open to new clients at the moment? And do people have to be in New Zealand to work with you at this stage?
Good question. So we're about 3 months booked out at the moment, but I've taken on 4 new people in the last month, and so I'm hoping that will get that waiting list down. So yeah, we're still taking on new people because I'm determined everyone on the planet can have access to integrative medicine. We're building up our team, but so I still do consults with patients, and we can do that by Zoom like you can, and we do. I like to see people. I love seeing people in person. Yeah. But with COVID, we've had to obviously change the way we do that. So we're doing a lot more Zoom consults now than we used to. And then I've got my clinic here in Timaru in Queenstown. But my websites will you'll have that on there anyway. So
yes, amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and I'm sure this is not the first or last conversation that we're going to have on the topic of integrative medicine. I'm really excited to see everything that you continue to bring out, and thank you so much for sharing everything with us today, and also thank you so much for helping Kate on her journey. I know that she just adored you, and I know that you're a huge part of that for her, and I know everyone listening that loves and knows Kate is grateful that she was surrounded by such an incredible support network.
Thanks so much, Nat. She was a really special person, and you were such a special friend to her. And it was such a relief for me to know that she had such great people around her. I feel talking to you today, I feel that renewed connection to Kate. She's always there, and I've got her picture as a bookmark in my book. But it's nice to talk to somebody who knew her so well.
Yeah. Oh, I feel her with me so often, which is sometimes a little bit strange and sometimes really, really comforting. And it is really nice to connect to, yeah, people who knew her and who were part of her world as well. And I know that all of the work that you're doing and that I'm doing, and she would just be so proud of, because, you know, if you know, she was one of the most determined people that I have ever met when it comes to, you know, spreading the message of health. And I think that so many people have been inspired by her and by her own journey and just her, you know, relentless dedication to living her best life, even right to the end. So I think that it's, you know, it's something to take away with us and to never take our health for granted, to check our boobs, because if Kate was here, she'd be like, all right, I'm going to sign off with check your boobs, everyone. And I think it's just, yeah, there's a lot that we can take from Kate's life and her message. And I hope to continue to spread that, you know, alongside people like you too.
Yeah, definitely. We're working on plans to help spread a message even further. So we'll have to talk more about that one.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, thank you again, and we will hear from you soon.